Welcome to Office Hours with John Gardner. The John N. Gardner Institute for Excellence in Undergraduate Education strives to advance higher education's larger goal of achieving equity and social justice.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host for Office Hours with John Gardner, namely, yours truly, John Gardner. And I'm welcoming today to my office, my podcast office, a colleague that I've known about a decade. She's a friend of my wife, Betsy Barefoot's, and mine. And we spent a week with her in her country, South Africa, and her university, which I'm sure she'll tell you about, University of Pretoria. And we came back to the United States realizing we had heard a phrase more times in a week than we had heard in years in the United States. And that was the phrase social justice. And we just couldn't get it out of our heads. And so we found our time with Dr. Ntabi Ugut to be really meaningful. We learned a great deal from her. And this woman is a leader, not only in her own institution, but in her country. And that's really a remarkable accomplishment. So it's a pleasure for me to welcome her to Office Hours with John Gardner. And she has a unique life story. And I'd just like to ask her to dive into that life story anywhere she wants and introduce herself to you in her own South African English. Okay.
Thank you very much, John, for inviting me for this podcast. And thank you for your kind words. My story, John, is intertwined with our very complex history as a country and the legacy of apartheid, which we are still grappling with almost 30 years after our democracy. It is a very complex story in the sense that it captures the experiences of Black academics and women in higher education in South Africa. And that is about the years 1988 to 2018, which was a major period of transformation. The uniqueness of my story lies in the fact that I grew up in exile. I was alienated from my country of birth, but I was nevertheless curious about how the apartheid system and the policy of providing inferior education to Black people affected my relatives back in South Africa. There, you know, I was in Lesotho, and also the broader society. Now, on my return to exile, I experienced firsthand what the impact of that educational system was and its manifestations in society. And many of us who came back around that time yearned to tackle the problem we encountered in the education system as our own way of making a contribution in our own small sphere of influence and as a way of healing our country. As a Black woman with a master's in analytical chemistry in the 1980s, and the first Black woman to attain a PhD at the University of the Witwatersrand in 1992, I was one of the rare ones, as you can imagine, with that kind of profile. Now, successful as I
seem, think you're still a rare one.
So, sorry, John.
I said, I think you're still a rare one.
Oh, thank you very much for that. So, successful as I seemingly was, I faced a number of difficulties in trying to advance an academic career in chemistry and teaching science. And those difficulties related to the harsh realities that faced the students that I was actually teaching. It came to my attention that they were facing realities such as a lack of food and substandard accommodation, and that interrupted their learning. That disturbed me quite a lot, and in the end changed my trajectory to, you know, from an analytical chemistry to a chemistry educator. And that actually opened what I would call the proverbial Pandora box, if you wish, and led me, you know, to try and understand how do you stem this cycle of disadvantage and poverty in the education system. So after championing the cause of disadvantaged Black students and access, especially to science, technology, engineering, and mathematics careers, I did achieve some record of accomplishment. You know, I ended up being one of the first people to contribute to the formation of a student success model in South Africa and a movement now called Siyaphumelela Network. And Siyaphumelela means we succeed. And there are now 19 out of 25 of our universities that have committed because of the work we started at the University of Pretoria to improving student success on a national level and through a data-led approach. So in a nutshell,
Would you spell that for us?
Siyaphumelela is S-I-Y-A-P-H-U-M-E-L-E-L-A. It's quite a long South African word. It means we succeed. So that was one of the accomplishments after about 2.5 decades of involvement. So in short, John, what I'm doing now, I'm still working with Siyaphumelela in addition to my position at the University of Pretoria. And I'm now assisting institutions through the executive management and the institution-wide student success committees to embed a culture of student success and to try and remove the differences in outcomes, such as graduation rates and throughput. So it's a long, complicated story, but I just want to say along the way, many people contributed to the success of the movement and shared my beliefs. And one of those people, John, is yourself and your wife, Betsy, and the Kresge Foundation. So I'm honored to still be involved in student success in South Africa. Thank you.
Oh, well, that's a very comprehensive and relatively succinct introduction. I bet our listeners would like to hear a little bit more about this notion of being exiled from your homeland and coming back and still being able to really make a difference. I mean, I wonder, you know, I suspect some of our listeners have felt exiled but didn't leave their own country to do that. It's somehow they felt alienated in their own country, never left it, but somehow got reintegrated and then moved forward through innovation. And obviously you have become much more, again, the word integrated through your entire nation, through your innovation. So could you talk a little bit more about how you moved from that return into maybe your first effort at innovation? How did you get started in that?
Yes. You're absolutely correct. Some people, you know, were alienated. Many South Africans, for example, did not leave their country, but were internally alienated, as it were. So I started teaching at what was called the University of Transkei. And that's, you know, it was a Black, you know, according to the nomenclature then, it was a Black university. And I taught first year chemistry students. And I taught chemistry outside the country. And I realized that the students were a bit different from those that I taught outside in Lesotho and also in Kenya. And they had a lot of potential, there was no doubt about it. But they didn't, you know, they had a problem of language, they couldn't grasp, you know, chemistry concepts. And that actually baffled me. I'd never experienced something like that among university students. So what we started doing was start doing tutoring, intensive tutoring, and many of these students actually thrived and succeeded. And it was the resilience of those students that actually thrived despite their conditions that actually gave me the belief that one can bring about change. So my innovations were modest. I started with with providing intensive tutoring. This was not a requirement at that university at the time. It was my own initiative, and it grew from there.
I want to stop you a minute because I think you said something really important that we all need to think about. You talked about what happened to you teaching at this Black University, introductory chemistry, and you said that they gave you the belief that you could change students. That is what you said, correct?
Yes, I did say it, yes.
All right. So I think that's something, the more of us can have that experience where we can see that somehow we have agency, there's some things we can do that lead to change in students. That's really important. And this happened to you early, and then you moved on from there once you saw that you could do that.
Yes, I think, overall, I think my social, I had a heightened sense of social, the need for social justice. You mentioned social justice at the beginning. And I believe that in order to be an innovator, you must be very conscious about your environment and really believe that you can change, you can change your environment for the better. And I believe that social consciousness really assisted me believing in student success efforts.
And your environment, I saw it myself, was at one time, up until about 20 years before I was there, the most rigidly segregated country in the world by race. And so the environment that you were realizing you could bring change about was, it compared to the environment that most American innovators know, much more severe. I mean, it's quite extraordinary that you could have this insight in that environment.
Yes, it was a very daunting prospect, even to many of my colleagues when I broached the idea of systemic change. It was a little bit of a dream, and it's something that many people believe. Why would you like to make your life that difficult if you wish? Why don't we make life easier? And I must say that as a lecturer, I realized early on that in order to make an impact, I need to be in leadership. I couldn't advocate for systemic change. As a lecturer, I had to go into management, and that's how I went into management, John.
But you said, I think what I'm hearing you say is that this dream you developed was based on the realization that that innovation was going to be very difficult. You had to make an intentional choice to do something difficult, correct?
Yes,
PhD level chemist in South Africa,
yes.
You could have done other things with chemistry at that level.
Absolutely.
It would not have been as difficult, correct?
Yes.
So I'm just trying to, I'm making a judgment here about what I think is particularly significant, that innovators have to intentionally be willing to do something that's very difficult. It's not the easy choice.
Absolutely. If you are going to be an innovator, you've got to be able, not to be deterred by the level of complexity of a problem. In fact, that should actually be a motivator. And I think that is one thing that you know, is very challenging about innovation. And there are no short-term, you know, it's not easy for people to see short-term gains. So, you know, in order to be an innovator, like I said, there's got to be social consciousness and then a systemic approach that will address the whole ecosystem of the problem. And you can imagine if you stand up as a deputy vice chancellor, as I was when I was at the University of Pretoria, and tell people that, you know, you're going to change undergraduate education fundamentally in the university, that rattles them. And like I said, it's a very daunting endeavor.
Talk about that. You told people you were going to fundamentally change graduate education?
Undergraduate education and student success. So that was my vision, when I was deputy vice chancellor of teaching and learning at the University of Pretoria. So is that kind of vision that one needs, and that kind of boldness and that kind of appetite to constantly explore how to shape the future. I was in a very complex situation because there were others who were defending the past. So as a leader, you know, you've got to be prepared not to defend the past or make apologies for anything or lament the past only, but actually try to shape the future.
You're just laying out so many wonderful principles here, one after the other. You know, you have to be bold. You have to have an appetite to want to shape the future. You have got to neither defend or lament the past. And that's saying a lot. I mean, it took a lot not to lament the past in South Africa.
Look,
you still have a dream? You've been at this, a long time. Do you still have a dream?
Oh, yes. I'm on a new project now, which I'll talk about maybe if we have some time. But sure. I definitely still have a dream. I think the educational project is will take a number of generations. It took us from 2009 to about 2018 for the University of Pretoria to realize that they actually have a very good student success model, which we call the Student Academic Development and Excellence Model. And it's only this week, that a book was published on the role of the University of Pretoria and student success in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And it covered a period of 2008 up to, this year. So it's a long time, but the seeds we planted then in 2008 when people, were actually daunted by the prospects. I'm very proud that that is part of my legacy at the university. And it is acknowledged by such. But somebody has got to plant the seed. I'm not part of those who are now celebrating, the outcomes. And as a leader, you know, you plant the seeds, not, you know, as they say, you plant a seed or plant a tree, and you don't necessarily have to sit under the shade. That's what leaders do.
So, if let's be specific, if you had sat under the shade, what would you be doing or not be doing?
You mean under the shade of the growing tree?
If you had instead of continuing to pursue a dream and doing difficult things, and if you had sat under the shade of the tree that you planted, what would you have been doing, just sitting under the shade or in the shade?
I don't understand, John. You see, what I was saying was that I planted the seeds for a tree which has grown now.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I moved on.
Right.
So other people are in the shade now, and I'm not against that. Mm-hmm. So you are saying if I was with them?
Yes.
I think I would have planted another one now.
All right.
There's one coming up already.
So it sounds like you're irrepressible. You would not have stayed in the shade, because if you planted another seed, you would have had to get out of the shade to do that, which is what you did. You planted another seed. So what was that seed?
You can enjoy the shade for some time, but I see my role as there are lots of trees to be planted. You know, we can't all sit under the shade of one tree, if you wish.
Right.
We've got to create a shade for more people, mm-hmm. if you see what I mean.
Yes. I do. I'm sure our listeners do, too. Yeah. So let me ask you about your methods for planting the seeds, for pursuing innovation. Some of the strategies or techniques that you have that you found successful.
Yes. I think some of them we've already mentioned. I think first of all is that social consciousness is a systemic approach. In this case, we use what you call systems theory, which looks at a problem from as broad as possible. And then one of the important things is it's one thing to have a vision. It's quite another to have the skills to institutionalize and scale that vision nationally and even globally. Mm-hmm. And equally important, you have to be able to manage the implementation and have realistic goals. So I really believe that one of my strengths is I don't just envision. I've been able to, to develop, I've been able to develop implementation plans. I've been able to have oversight and dedicated, to ensure that they succeed. And the last thing I would say, maybe John, is that an enabling environment, when you visited our university, together with Betsy, I think you could tell that right from the executive management, the vice chancellor then.
I saw her.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Without the support of leadership and that enabling environment, you can never, innovation doesn't thrive under, leadership that looks for short-term solutions.
But at the same time, you had the ability to influence her. You had to persuade her that if she supported you, that she was going to get some results.
Absolutely. I think she was convinced about, my bona fides, if I could put it that way. And she understood that I had the experience, but I also had the passion. And I think together we shared that desire to bring social, justice. Yeah. And we had that heightened sensitivity. There are people who may be in a leadership position, but their sensitivity to social problems is not as heightened as it should be. And I'm not making a judgment here. We're just different.
Well, you had students, as I saw, who were hungry and who were not adequately clothed to come in out of the bush. And you had to meet their total human needs before they could discover what they could do in the university environment.
Yes, that was something which was really heartbreaking, actually. Because I grew up, at least I realized then that I realized that I grew up advantaged, because I must admit food was never a problem when I grew up in exile. And it never occurred to me that before, you know, you can consider your intellectual ability, you have to think about whether you have food or not. Yeah. So that led me to a holistic thinking about what I call now a holistic development to student success. I was very cognitively driven. I believed you had to study chemistry, you have to understand concepts in chemistry, that is it. The rest will take care of themselves. But that was not the case, you know, on my return to South Africa. So that first year experience, you know, that you taught me about, John, that concept of first year experience was a very important one. Students are affected right from the first year of study if they don't have food and accommodation and funding and that kind of, yeah.
When you use the term first year experience in the context of South African higher education, what do you mean by that, Dr. Ogut?
Yeah, that's a very good question, John. What we mean by that is in South Africa, there's a sense in which students can have access, or if you wish, physical access to the institution, but they don't have access to the knowledge. It's called epistemological access. Mm-hmm. And what epistemological access means is that you are physically in an environment, but you are unable to access the knowledge. It could be the language is, you know, there's an accumulation of disadvantage which inhibits you from accessing, you know, the knowledge that the institution, you know, may provide. So that is a key problem, you know, in South Africa.
Yes, I think it's a global one, but mm-hmm. when you're most focused on it is in South Africa, of course. Would you tell us a little bit about how you were able to move your work and its influence beyond the University of Pretoria to the broader structure of higher education in South Africa? How did you do that? How does one person move beyond the institutional to the national?
Yes, that was unintentional. I never set out. I never even thought it would be a national model, you know, to be honest. But there were a number of synergistic things that happened at the time. I attended an Achieving the Dream conference in North Carolina, John, that was funded by the Kresge Foundation. Right. And that is the time when we met, actually. I don't know whether you recall that.
I do.
So on my return from that conference, that's when I started a student success, institution-wide student success committee within the University of Pretoria. And my trip to North Carolina was funded by the Kresge Foundation. And the work that we were doing on student success succeeded over a period of 5 years. And during that period, the Kresge Foundation was funding South African universities and a few of the South African universities. And at the end of the 5 years, they needed to decide what to continue funding within South African universities. And the student success project at the University of Pretoria was so successful that they believed that, you know, there was an alignment between the Kresge Foundation, because they also stand for social justice, and what we are doing. And they decided they will fund student success. And that's how it became known in the sector, and other universities started picking it from there. Mm-hmm. And then we organized a national conference funded again by Bill Moses of the Kresge Foundation. And through that, many universities came to, you know, we became an exemplar of good student success models.
It's really exciting. I mean, I see a number of parallels there to something that I did, which is like you, through conferences, getting more people involved and moving what had started very locally to a more national focus. So where is this movement right now in South Africa? You've been at this for a good 20 years. Where is this now, would you describe?
Yes, the movement has been running since 2013. Yeah, it's almost, it's since 2013. It's now, like I said, our higher education system is not as large as yours. So we have 25 universities, and 19 of those 25 universities have now bought into the idea of introducing a culture of student success. There's an annual conference which takes place. There are several workshops throughout the year, and I'm one of what are called student success coaches. There are six of us, the first ever in South Africa, and we are allocated a number of institutions to assist them as the coaches to institutionalize student success. So there's a community of practice, a huge one of the 19 institutions, and you know, it's a thriving movement, and it's actually also recognized by government, and it's funded. You know, some projects are funded within the institutions, and by government, the Department of Education.
Are any other South African nations in Africa emulating any aspect of this?
Yes, we had a student access and success conference at the University of Nairobi. Kenyatta University in Nairobi, I beg your pardon, it was in the University of Nairobi, some 7 years ago. But many, you know, South Africa has a unique history. So many African universities have not taken up to student success like South Africa is. Namibia has a similar history, and they have, they have a student success interest and agenda. Mm-hmm. But not many other countries that I know of in Africa.
Well, not yet, but...
not yet, yes.
Not yet, right. But you have time, and the jury is still out.
It is out, yes.
Yeah. Can you tell us, I know you can, but will you please tell us a little bit about your own personal style of collaboration? How do you go about collaborating with people?
Yes. When I was given the task of developing a student success model, or you know, innovating in undergraduate education in the University of Pretoria, I had to look for similar contexts. And you know, throughout the world, where we could borrow models, if you wish. So my style is often to look at the context we are in, find a comparative context and comparable context, and really attend conferences there, and try to make meet people who think similarly, and connect with them. That's all I do, actually.
Uh-huh. Now, it's not just you doing this, it's others doing this to you, right? Reaching out to you.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Others also, of course, through your work that you publish also, that's how we get to network.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said think similarly. If I didn't know anything about this work, how would you describe what it means to think similarly? What is it about your thinking that you're trying to get people to buy into? Other than, you know, you've talked about how you've discovered that students really do have potential. They can be successful in spite of these enormous problems. But what else about your thinking? Is there a no good doctrine or formula?
Yes, you know, one of the things I've always believed in, I don't know whether I should call it doctrine. Quite early in my career, I was convinced that there was a moral obligation on behalf of universities that if they admit students based on whatever criteria they have developed, is their moral obligation to ensure that the students succeed. And I later learned, from you, John, and people like Vincent Tinto, that in fact, you know, this was not just, I mean, whereas it was a moral obligation to me, that there were several other people in the world that shared in this belief. So if that is what you are thinking of, John, that's one of the things I strongly believed in. And that might be something that probably would be an identifier if you want to identify what it is that drove me. That is what actually drove me in my student success work.
So let's repeat that. You're driven by a moral obligation.
Yes, I do think that we have a moral obligation. If we say to students, the University of Pretoria considers you to have the ability, given the criteria that we have set, that you qualify to enter this institution, I think that it has always been my philosophical departure to say that once that has been, the university has admitted one, then they have the academic and moral responsibility to use all kinds of innovative teaching and learning methodologies to ensure that those students succeed. So this for me was an unwavering approach of mine, and I later learned, was a practice endorsed by renowned first year experience advocates like yourself, John, and Vincent Tinto, as I said. So it was, for my part, it was a moral duty. And on the flip side, I also believe that students have the responsibility for their studies and should be aware of their own responsibilities to access all the avenues that are provided for enriching their student experience. So it's not a question of the obligation that the university has, but it's also the responsibility of the student to access the different avenues provided.
I certainly agree with that. The students have to do their share too, but it's what we're both saying is that institutions have to meet a certain level of responsibility towards the students and not just simply admit them and then, you know, sink or swim. I definitely agree.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So when you're a member of a global group now that we call the Global Forum for Student Success, and as you know, we're looking for global similarities and differences in efforts to make university and college students successful. What would you say is similar and or different that you're finding in what you're trying to do in South Africa? And you see other student success educators in other places in the world trying to do. What do we do? What do we got in common? But how do we differ?
Yes. I think there's a lot in common that we do. One of the things, for example, that is very common throughout the world is determining graduate attributes. And I believe that, we have similar exit aspirations in the kinds of graduates that we would like to produce. You know, they have to be exposed globally and locally relevant. You know, they have to be exposed to the 4IR revolution and so on. And they have to have other attributes for being successful beyond their academic work, but also have, critical thinking skills and social skills and, working in, in teams and so on. So graduate attributes, I think, if one could say, if you set the exit, the exit attributes, and those go beyond whether students have passed the discipline or not. These are attributes that should be embedded in all academic programs. So in that sense, I think there's a lot of similarity. Where there are differences is the level of expertise of the students that actually come in that would like to reach this same exit outcomes that we all aspire to have. So student success then is defined between those two poles, if you wish, the entry and the exit. And I think in between there, that's where we do a number of things in a very different way. Mm-hmm. And what happens in most institutions in South Africa is very ad hoc interventions that are not systematized, are not part of any strategic vision of the university, are not, and are very faculty specific. And I'm not saying that there cannot be some idiosyncrasies in terms of disciplinary fields, but is systematizing and being able to have a systemic data-driven way of measuring both the data-driven and qualitative of measuring your outcomes and not just looking at at exit attributes without ensuring how you'll attain those exit attributes in your students and whatever other matrix you may have for throughput in different disciplines or graduation rates in different institutions. So I think it's looking critically on how people systematize within an institution all their student efforts, whether it's in teaching and learning, whether it's in student support, and across different disciplines.
I think it would be accurate, correct me if this is not accurate, but I think it'd be accurate to say that both you and I, we don't have to still be doing this work. We could be spending time with grandchildren, and I know you have that opportunity. we could be doing a lot of reading and thinking and writing. But I'm assuming you're going to keep carrying on, aren't you? You're not ready to cash it in, right?
No, I've after spending almost 3.5 decades in higher education, John, I have realized that there's still one more thing I need to do. And I've started it now post-retirement. I retired 2 months ago, actually. I'm also convinced that while we now have a model for undergraduate student success, the articulation with our high school sector is still not as good as it should be. So I'm running now a pre-university academy.
A pre-university academy, okay. Yes. And this is going to be a replicable model for other places in South Africa?
It is a University of Pretoria pre-university academy.
Mm-hmm. So you're not retired?
Sorry. Well, I'm statutorily retired.
Oh, okay.
But
that sounds like a very semantic, it's more than a semantic, it's a technical designation. Okay.
Statutorily, yes, but not in terms of work.
Oh, I like that idea. I think it'd be terrible for you to retire. So, all right. So now you're going to do something that's maybe even more difficult. You're going to try and address the pre-higher education sector. You're going to be looking at the secondary sector for the transition to university. Is that correct?
Yes, we've been doing it in South Africa for years, actually, simultaneously as we're looking for solutions in the articulation between the two sectors and in one sector and also in the other. So I have done work in this area also quite for some time. And what it entails is providing is really recognizing that the high school system has a broad mandate to educate students of different abilities, and only a very small percentage qualify for university. Right. And it is this small percentage, Don, that we wrestle with when they reach university. Mm-hmm. Our student success efforts are on a tiny percentage of students who are actually the best in the high school sector. Now the question is, how come those students that actually excelled are the ones we are actually not able to succeed? How do we provide academic enrichment pre-university to the talented students that are likely to succeed into university? I know the U.S. has those university models for modules for high school students. We are talking about a slightly different thing here. Our regulatory framework doesn't allow that, but we are talking of embedding, for example, our pre-university curriculum teaches philosophy as a subject to grade 10. And these are 16-year-olds. Now, this, philosophy teaches argumentation, for example, and drawing logical conclusions from available information or data. This is a key a skill in the scientific method. But we do not, introduce children. We do not socialize them into what the academy is all about early enough. We teach them procedurally, we don't teach them conceptually, and then we expect them all of a sudden to change when they get to university. And that is a big problem.
Yes.
So now that we have a national movement, I think I can move on to something else, John.
Well, I'm glad to know this, because now I have one more thing to keep asking you about how you're doing. And I do want to, if you haven't heard of the U.S. model, what we call Upward Bound in the TRIO programs, you and I should talk about those, because it's one of the things that I've found is most successful in preparing secondary school students for college. But I tell you, I'd like to just wind this up by seeing if I can get you to agree to this. I'm concluding even more from listening to you that an innovator, a higher education innovator, who has a sense of moral obligation coupled with a dream that her work is never done. You will not finish. You are going to persist. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. John.
Yeah.
You just take a pause and then you start again.
Yeah. Well, I hope that you and I can both keep starting again, because it's very sustaining It's a form of rejuvenation that, you know, leads us to other innovations. And I am optimistic that you have inspired some people who maybe can imagine they are now where you were when you had just completed a terminal degree. And you saw a lot of barriers in your country to allowing, quote, people like me or you to do such and such, but you did it anyway. I want to thank you, Dr. Agoud, for this wonderful conversation. And I'm going to stay in touch with you about this latest dream of yours. I'm glad to know about it. It's a really conversation for me to learn about it. So I really am hopeful that you'll, again, come up with a national model for South Africa. You're an inspiration. Thank you very much. Best wishes to you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, John, and best wishes to you too.
Thank you. We'll talk soon. Thank you. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for Office Hours with John Gardner. Today's podcast is sponsored by the Gardner Institute. And we wish to thank our guests and the entire team who make this podcast possible.